Welcome to another episode of the Deborah Health Report, where we dive into current health and medical topics to keep the Delaware Valley informed and updated. The conversation continues with interventional cardiologist Dr. Richard Kovach as we discuss vascular disease, including how it's diagnosed, treated, and prevented. Here's Rasa Kay.
Hi, I'm Rasa Kay. We continue our discussion of aortic valve disease with a detailed look at valve repair and replacement. There's no one-size-fits-all solution for every case, so the criteria and considerations are balanced very carefully. Deborah interventional cardiologist Dr. Richard Kovach describes the process and the team approach at Deborah.
So at what point do you guys decide to go in and replace?
Right now, indications for valve replacement are for severe aortic stenosis, when the valve reaches that point where the patient is symptomatic, and by all the numbers, the degree of stenosis is severe. And that at that point, we have an indication that we can no longer manage this with medications to address the patient's symptoms. This is a point where we need to really go in there and take care of the valve one way or the other.
Now, up until that point, what are the kinds of complications that aortic valve disease can lead to? I mean, what other problems can it cause?
One of the most common things is heart failure. Again, with the weakening of the heart muscle and the heart not pumping very efficiently, that can lead to the blood volume and pressure backing up into the lungs, which makes you short of breath. If you get high blood pressure in the lungs and you're not mobilizing your fluid normally, it can lead to swelling in the legs, worsening symptoms, shortness of breath, heart failure we talked about. It can lead to chest pain. Is often one of the symptoms of worsening aortic stenosis. Lightheadedness. Patients will tell us, you know, when I stand up quickly, I get lightheaded. I feel like I'm going to pass out. And sometimes they do pass out. And the reason behind that, again, is that when you stand up quickly, gravity pulls the blood to the feet. And the normal response for the heart is to pump harder, keep the blood going to your brain so that the blood pressure is maintained up to the brain. Now, if the heart is having trouble keeping up, pumping through that valve, again, your blood pressure can drop quickly and you can pass out.
So if the valve issue is managed well or corrected, a lot of these things will settle down?
Like with anything, you're still probably better off having your own valve in as long as we can, because anytime you put a prosthetic device in somebody, there's complications and potential risks of doing that. So again, it's a balance of how can we manage the patient's symptoms and to the point where something really needs to be done about the valve.
Well, so here we are. Let's say you got to do something about the valve. What are the options and how do they work?
The two options, again, we'll take aortic stenosis at this point in time, would be surgical valve replacement or what's called transcatheter aortic valve replacement, or TAVR for short. And that's where we actually deploy a valve through a puncture in the groin, just like when we perform a heart catheterization. Which way we go, again, depends on a lot of factors. Classically, and before we had TAVR, obviously, the only way to go was open heart surgery. With that, we had two types of valves to put in, a mechanical valve or a tissue valve. The mechanical valves, properly managed, patient takes care of themselves, should last the rest of the patient's life. Generally, we'll put mechanical valves in patients who are younger. Say somebody needs a valve replacement in their 50s or 60s, and we expect them to live another 20 or 30 years, as long as they can be on anticoagulation, because putting in a mechanical valve also means lifelong anticoagulation. So no clot forms on the valve. If a patient is more elderly and surgery was the only option, we would typically put in a tissue valve. The upside of the tissue valve is you don't need to be on long-term anticoagulation, so you avoid the risks of bleeding. Especially as a patient gets older and more frail, you know, you can run into risks with falling, hitting your head, bleeding, et cetera. Or if you have, you know, problems with ulcers or polyps and things like that, or that in your bowel that are going to make you bleed, anything that predisposes you to bleed is going to make us, would make the surgeon more likely to put in a tissue valve. The downside of a tissue valve is that because it's tissue, like your native valve, is that over time that valve could also degenerate and become stiff or leak. A time frame that we usually would quote our patients would be 10 to 15 years before that valve might need to be replaced again.
What kind of tissue?
It's another actually common misconception. Patients will ask you, did I get a cow valve or a pig valve? okay, you know, we didn't cut a valve out of a pig or cut a valve out of a cow and sew it into the position. Those valves are made out of, typically made out of what's called the pericardium, which is the sac that surrounds the heart. It's very tough, very durable material that's highly, highly processed. You know, anytime a foreign body is in your body, you can reject it. All the things that make us reject foreign tissue are removed from that tissue. So the tissue is basically inert. And it's processed also to make it tough and durable. And then those leaflets are actually the way we can match the size of the valve to the size of the patient's own original valve or the size of their aorta. Those valves would be cut into leaflets, the shape of the normal leaflet, and actually sewn by hand onto the frame of the valve. It's a very, very incredibly tedious, time-consuming work. This is the kind of stuff that's done under a microscope, you know, by hand. The bottom line is you really didn't get a cow or pig valve. You got cow or pig pericardium that's been shaped into the exact size that you need for your body. Now, the TAVR valves are also made out of the same material, either from a pig or from a cow. And bovine, we'll refer to them as a bovine.
So there's tissue in a TAVR.
Yeah, there's tissue in a TAVR, yeah. When TAVR valves were first released, first we put them in patients who are extraordinarily or not surgical candidates who are extremely high risk, then plain high risk because of other medical issues, then moderate risk, then low risk. The two main valves that we use now have all been approved for anything from low risk to moderate to high risk. And by that we mean, you know, the patient's other, their age, their frailty, their other medical problems that may or may not make them at high risk or medium, moderate risk or low risk for surgery. Interesting thing about the TAVR valves is we initially assumed that their longevity would be about the same as the surgical valves because you're making out of the same tissue that was used in the tissue surgical valves. But some of the more recent studies have actually suggested that they may be lasting longer than the surgical tissue valves. Exact reasons are not clear yet, but probably one of the reasons is that, number one, the technology continuously improves in the way the tissue is processed. Number two is, and this may also not make intuitive sense, is that the TAVR valves are actually larger than the surgical valves. Surgical valves come, when you have surgery, whether it's a tissue valve or a mechanical valve, the old valve is cut out. The new valve comes mounted in something called a sewing ring that the surgeons use to sew into position. That sewing ring takes up a lot of space, more than the TAVR valve. The TAVR valve is basically made out of tissue and a valve frame, which is very thin, the valve frame. So in general, when we put in a TAVR valve, the old valve is pushed out of the way. It's not removed. And the new frame opens up with the tissue inside it and starts to work immediately. The fact that it's a larger valve, you know, if you start with a smaller hole, maybe it's going to stiffen up sooner than if you start with a bigger hole or a bigger valve. So right now, again, we're still putting TAVR valves in patients who have severe aortic stenosis. We are now, though, starting studies looking at putting, because the TAVR valves have been so successful, putting the TAVR valves in patients who are considered moderate severity but symptomatic, mm-hmm. You know, because, again, symptoms don't necessarily correlate with the severity of the disease. You know, putting things in perspective, you know, we see patients who have a tiny blockage in one artery, have severe chest pain, and a patient who's had multiple heart attacks who never even do it because they don't get pain. Same things, your degree of symptoms can be extremely variable. Everyone's different, and everybody's tolerance of symptoms is different. So the studies going on now are, one of them we're participating in is looking at somebody who's moderate risk but very symptomatic. We've tried medicines, it's not working. They're still interfering with their lifestyle, their daily activities. So now we actually, under a research protocol, have the ability to put the TAVR valve in moderate aortic stenosis.
We've been talking about TAVR now for years, yeah. But I guess it just never really clicked with me that, you know, you're going up through the groin and you're positioning the thing. And yeah, you're not taking the old valve out. No. So if that defective valve is still just sitting there around the TAVR that's in there and doing the work, is there any degradation or any further calcification of that old valve?
Whether or not it degrades further is really doesn't matter because it's not functioning anymore. It's just pushed out of the way.
Yeah, there's just no problem.
Lining of the heart probably continues to grow over that as well as the outside of the new valve. And they all become scarred over. The only thing we worry about is when we push that, and again, not to get too technical, is when we push that old valve out of the way, is if the leaflets move, where the arteries come off that feed the heart muscle, is in that same general area. And sometimes if it's a very long valve or if the distance to where the coronary artery comes off is very short, there's a potential for that old valve to cover over the heart artery, which would not be a good thing for obvious reasons. So that's why all these patients, in addition to the echocardiogram, we did get a CAT scan of the heart, take very precise measurements. But sometimes, even if a patient really needs a valve, can't get a surgical valve, severely symptomatic, there are ways of dealing with those, either long valves or low-lying heart arteries. We can actually have a way of stenting those arteries to get the blood to go around the old valve as it's pushed out of the way.
All the more reason to go somewhere where you guys do a lot of TAVR. You've seen it before, and you know exactly what to do.
And one of the reasons it actually takes a team approach, not only is that the best way to take care of the patient, but it's actually mandated by the FDA that anytime we put in a TAVR valve, it's a team discussion about what kind of valve we're going to put in, what size we're going to put in. It's made up of someone like myself, who's an interventional cardiologist, a cardiac surgeon, an echocardiographer, or today we refer to him as a very advanced imager, someone who can give us very, very clear pictures of the heart structures. We have a valve coordinator that arranges all the testing that needs to be done ahead of time to make sure that all the ducts are lined up properly. CAT scan of the heart. We also need to look at the arteries that feed the legs to make sure these are bigger catheters than too big to put up through the wrist the way we do a lot of the catheterizations now. So we got to make sure these arteries are big enough. If not, we may need to consider what we call alternative access, where we go into an artery into the collarbone or directly into through a tiny incision into the aorta rather than through the legs. We need to make sure that we do a dental clearance on all patients to make sure that there's no risk for infection. The easiest ones to do are the patients that have full dentures. They have no dental problem that we need to worry about. And we also check the carotid arteries to make sure that there's no significant obstruction up in the carotid arteries that may predispose or put the patient at increased risk for having a stroke during the procedure.
If someone presents with an aortic valve issue, is that an indication of another issue elsewhere in the system?
Not necessarily. We always do a heart catheterization, you know, looking at the heart arteries to make sure that there's no obstruction in the heart arteries that needs to be addressed. But we'll see patients who have critical aortic stenosis whose arteries are clean as a whistle, and vice versa, patients with mild aortic stenosis who have terrible obstructions in their heart arteries. So the two aren't necessarily related, unless, you know, things like chronic kidney disease predisposes you to aortic stenosis and also predisposes you to develop atherosclerosis or developing blockages in the arteries. Other than the consequences of having a diseased valve, sometimes patients have what we call AVMs, arterial venous malformations. It's not clear what the exact association between the two, and it typically occurs in the small bowel, so it's things that we can't see in an upper GI, upper scope or lower scope. Those patients at times are predisposed to bleeding because it's kind of a fragile network of vessels that are close to the surface of the small bowel. It's not an area that's easily visualized unless you do something like a capsule endoscopy. If you have one of the genetic disorders like Marfan's syndrome, you can have all sorts of connective tissue issues all over the body. You know, hypertension can accelerate aortic valvular disease, so not directly related to the valve, but we know hypertension is one of the biggest predictors of cardiovascular morbidity and mortality. You know, it increases your risk for stroke, increases your risk for kidney dysfunction, heart attack, heart failure, et cetera. All these things are interrelated.
So what is the patient experience if they're having a TAVR? The recovery time, your prep is just, it's a monster, everything you're checking. But what is the patient experience when we come right down to having it done?
Generally speaking, it's, compared to surgery, it's a relatively benign experience. There's been a progression. Initially, when we started doing this, that we did the patient under general anesthesia. Now we do it under what's called MACR. It's sedation, very heavy sedation or anesthesia monitored by an anesthesiologist where the patient is asleep, but they're not on a breathing machine. They don't have a tube down their throat. Eventually, we'll be moving towards what we just call conscious sedation, where we just give the patient a little to relax, take the edge off. Really, not much more is needed than that. Europe is always ahead of us than this. They've been doing patients with conscious sedation for a decade or longer.
I don't know that I would want to know if this is going on. I like the sleep option. I like that heavy sleep option a lot. Oh my gosh, conscious sedation?
But beyond that, the procedure like heart catheterization is done through a couple punctures in the groin. There's typically what we do is one puncture in the artery to deliver, put in a large, what we call sheath, to deliver the valve. One puncture in the vein to pass up a temporary pacemaking catheter, and I'll get back to why we do that in a moment. And one catheter usually in the wrist, in the artery in the wrist, typically put what we call closure devices in those sites in the groin and pressure dressing on the artery in the wrist when we're done. And the patient has a couple Band-Aids for their trouble when they're done. We put in the temporary pacemaking catheter because obviously while we're doing this procedure, the heart is beating and we need to position that valve very precisely. So if you can imagine, if the heart's beating and we're trying to position that valve in exactly the right spot, that heart's going to be pushing that valve back and forth, and you don't want to sort of, okay, wait, now. You can't, has to be a little bit more precise than that. So we typically pace the patient very rapidly, anywhere from 140 to 180 beats per minute. For 5 or 10 seconds, we're pacing it so quickly that the heart is almost standing still. That we know the precise position, and it only takes a few seconds to deploy the valve. And then we turn the pacemaker off and the patient returns to their normal heart rhythm.
So 5 or 10 seconds, the heart is essentially beating so quickly, it's like it's vibrating.
It's almost like it's vibrating. And so it's not, and we watch, you'll see the pressure will drop. At that point, we know nothing's going to be moving and we can deploy the valve.
Yeah, because I was getting like this image of jump roping when you were talking about, when the heart's beating and it's like, okay, No, not now.
Exactly.
So I get it, but that's fascinating to consider.
And then this one in the wrist is just, we also want to visualize what we're doing. So, we can do it with an echocardiogram, what's called transesophageal echocardiogram down the throat, but only in very specific circumstances do we use that. We put a catheter up through the wrist to the same area so we can inject dye and confirm our position as we deploy the valve.
So how fast is the patient going to experience improved symptoms?
Almost immediately, because as soon as the valve is deployed, it's open, it's working normally. So all that stress that was being put on the heart should be relieved instantly as well. Unlike open heart surgery, where there's sternotomy that has to heal and several days in the hospital, most of our patients go home the following morning. After the procedure, we get them out of bed later that day, sit them up, just make sure that there's no bleeding at the puncture sites. But again, we typically use suture devices or other types of plugs to close up the puncture sites. And the patients go home the next day. Typically, the only patients that would not go home the next day are patients who maybe have multiple other medical problems. They've had such severe aortic stenosis that they're very debilitated and weak and fragile and whatnot, and we may want to send those patients, not from the standpoint of the procedure, but due to their overall deconditioning, may want to send them to rehab afterwards. Technically, from the standpoint of the valve, there's virtually no recovery. From the standpoint of the puncture sites, it's really nothing strenuous for a couple days, so you don't have any bleeding at the puncture site, no driving, no heavy lifting, that sort of thing. The only other thing that might keep the patient in the hospital another day or two is a small percentage of patients will need a permanent pacemaker. And this actually applies to both surgery and to TAVR procedure. Where the valve ring sits is also very close proximity to where some of the conduction fibers come through that make the ventricles contract. And sometimes either from, in the case of TAVR, from the pressure of the valve on that conduction tissue as we expand the valve, or in the case of surgery, inadvertently putting a suture through that area and damaging the conduction tissue. Again, it's a very small percentage of patients that happens to. So we monitor the rhythm very closely afterwards.
So what's the follow-up like?
General follow-up is we'll see those patients again in the office probably usually a week after the procedure. We get an echocardiogram typically the morning before they leave. To take it one step back, we're getting to the point where we're not considering some patients going home the same day. So you come and have your valve in the morning and go home in the evening. If you're low risk, if you're able to get up and ambulate, you may be going home the same day, which is a far cry from 20, 30 years ago. It used to be 10 days in the hospital and a very prolonged recovery. But anyhow, they'll get a follow-up echocardiogram when they come back as well to make sure that the valve is continuing to function normally. And then there's a series of scheduled routine follow-ups, but all office follow-ups after that, just to make as we would with after any cardiac procedure.
That's Deborah interventional cardiologist Dr. Richard Kovach. Join us next month as we tackle another topic that impacts your health or that of a loved one. As always, the new podcast drops the first Wednesday of the month. I'm Rasa Kay.
You can always listen to all of the informative Deborah Doctor interviews at DeborahHealthReport.com. Schedule an appointment at DemandDeborah.org.